California just passed the Directed Trust Statute. But what does that mean exactly? Maybe you've heard the term Directed Trust, maybe you haven't. Maybe you've worked with Directed Trust created in other states. In this episode of Trust Me, Let's Get Direct about California Directed Trust, our guests, Michael Rosenprinz and David Kongian of Loeb & Loeb, will go over Directed Trust basics. We'll also review the specifics of California's new Directed Trust Statute. I'm Anna Solomon of Fiduciary Trust. I'm a member of the Executive Committee of the Trust and Estate Section of the California Lawyers Association, and I'll be your host for this episode of Trust Me.
Welcome to Trust Me, the official podcast of the Trust and Estate Section of the California Lawyers Association. The Trust and Estate Section seeks to further the knowledge of practitioners through updates and a wide range of educational opportunities. In addition, the section monitors and participates in the formation of laws and regulations that impact the trust and estates field and represents section members in the governance of the California Lawyers Association. And now, to your host of today's podcast.
Hi, Michael and David. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be here.
Hi, happy to be here.
So California now has directed trusts. But before we get into the details of the new statute, why don't you tell us just in general, what is a directed trust?
In a traditional trust, the trustee is the person who's responsible for all aspects of the trust administration. So whether it be making investment decisions, distribution decisions, or more of the administrative tasks like preparing financials and filing tax returns, when you get into a directed trust, you actually bifurcate those roles among different people. So just as a common example, the trust may have a role of distribution director who directs the trust distributions. And then there's an investment director who may direct the trustee as to trust investments, which ultimately then just leaves the trustee responsible for more of the back office work. So filing the tax returns and preparing financials and also executing the directions that come from the directors.
So do you mean to say, let's say in a quote unquote regular trust, you could not bifurcate the responsibilities?
So in a traditional trust, you may put those provisions in there so you can create the role of directors. But what was an issue with California law prior to the statute was that you just don't know what level of liability the trustee has and to what degree they have responsibilities to oversee and make sure that the directors are doing their job properly.
I think that's a good point. So even before California had a directed trust statute, you could technically put in different responsibilities, but per the statute, maybe everybody's still responsible. Everybody still has a fiduciary duty, even though they may not have that responsibility, right?
Right, exactly.
So Michael, let me ask you, so for our new attorneys and maybe our non-planners out there, why would a client want to set up a directed trust?
I think as people really start to learn about directed trusts, I think more clients will realize that this is a structure that could be really beneficial to them. The main reason why people would typically like to set up directed trusts is that they've got different people in mind that they think would be really good at carrying out different duties associated with the trust. For example, they might have a family member who could be good at making distributions, and they could have someone who's really savvy in the financial sense, and they'd like that person to be in charge of investments. Ultimately, they don't have one person who they think is good at everything a trustee needs to do and also has the resources and capability to fulfill all of the trustee's administrative duties.
Can you give me an example of a general family situation where they would use a directed trust?
Sure. A really common example are clients that have a closely held business and they want to make sure that it's managed appropriately. They'd like someone who has the knowledge and skill to manage that business effectively, but that person might not be someone who's up for fulfilling all the other duties of a trustee and might not be in a good position to make distributions. In a case like that, they could name the person who has the knowledge and skills related to the business as an investment advisor, or perhaps as some sort of special business advisor that would direct the trustee how to manage the business and make decisions and vote the stock or other interests of the entity that holds the business, but that person wouldn't be responsible for the other trust duties.
I think that makes sense. And we've touched upon this a little bit, but can you have other advisors? I know commonly, I think people think of directed trusts with investment advisors, but you can have other advisors, right?
Definitely. The statute doesn't place a limitation as to what duties a trust director or advisor can hold. So another common role would be a distribution advisor who directs the trustee about making distributions from the trust. But you could isolate any of the commonly held powers and duties of a trustee and put that in the hands of a trust director.
We talked about this statute and directed trust being new to California, but as planners, a lot of us have worked with directed trusts. Have you worked with clients in other jurisdictions, directed trusts?
Yeah, so while directed trusts are new to California, we are a bit late to the game. So a lot of other jurisdictions, including Delaware and Nevada, Wyoming, have had these statutes in place for a while. And aside from their directed trust statute, they have very trust favorable laws. And so a lot of out-of-state clients like to establish trusts there. And when they do, including California resident clients who set up trusts in these jurisdictions, rely on the directed trust statutes there so that they would have a corporate trustee who's resident in these states, but they retain all of the controls in terms of investment decisions, distribution decisions. They can allocate among family members or trusted advisors or even amongst themselves.
I think it's a good point to know because a lot of people who are not estate planners and maybe in litigation, just to know that this is not necessarily a new concept, even though it's a new statute in California.
A lot of people, even within California, have been taking advantage of directed trust statutes, although not necessarily in California.
Let's talk about the specific statute. It was enacted in 2023, effective January 1st, 2024. And the bill was brought forth by the Trust and Estate section of the California Lawyers Association, and it's mostly taken from the uniform law. So let's just dig into the statute. So what type of trust does the statute apply to?
So really, the statute could apply to any trust. As I mentioned earlier, you can put these provisions in there even before the act was in place. So what the statute actually accomplishes is that as of January 1, 2024, for any trust that's principally administered in California, the statute would kick in and take over and apply.
So what you're saying is, let's say somebody before January 1st, 2024, had maybe different roles for different advisors or trustees in their trust, any action that they would take after January 1st, 2024, then maybe the statute kicks in for them. Is that right? Am I thinking about that correctly?
That's right. So as of January 1, you have the certainty of protection of the statute.
Got it. I want to talk the specific terminology in the California statute. What are these different advisors or these players technically called? So who are our key players and what are their roles? Michael, do you want to take this one?
Sure. So the two main roles in a directed trust have confusingly similar names. There's the directed trustee, which is a trustee that's subject to direction from a trust director. And as you may have guessed, the second role is the trust director, who is able to give instruction or direction to the trustee.
So it's the trust director who gives the direction to the directed trustee, right?
Yeah, it feels like we're just kind of mixing and matching the words trustee and direction back and forth all the time. But that's exactly right. And even though these terms sound similar, it's really just the question of who's getting the direction and who's giving the direction.
That's correct. And so we have this power of direction. And again, it's the trust director that has the power of direction to direct the directed trustee. So what is the power of direction?
The power of direction is actually defined quite broadly in the statute. Subject to a few minor exceptions, it's really any power over a trust that is granted to a person who's not the trustee.
Again, a lot of people think of directed trusts and just having like an investment, a trust director, but you can really have any power over anything in the trust per the statute, right?
Right. So as long as it's not within the few exceptions that we'll discuss in a bit, but any other power that's enumerated in the trust that's given to somebody to perform while they're not serving as trustee is a power of direction.
Well, let's talk about the exceptions now. So what are some of those exceptions?
Broadly, almost any fiduciary power is going to be a potential power of direction. What's excluded are these common non-fiduciary powers. The one that you see the most is a power of appointment held by a beneficiary. Power of appointment is typically exercised in an individual capacity and accordingly is not held to a fiduciary standard. And so that could not be a power of direction. Another power would be the power to appoint or remove a trustee or another officer. These almost always are carved out from fiduciary responsibilities. So when someone is granted the power to fire a trustee or hire another trustee or replace a trustee, because that's not a fiduciary power, that's not going to be a power of direction.
I think all of that makes sense. Anything else?
There also is the settlor's power to revoke a trust. So in the standard living trust that we set up for clients, the settlor retains the power to revoke the trust. That's obviously not exercisable in a fiduciary capacity, and so is also excluded from the definition of power of direction. One other exception, it's tax related. So it's certain powers that the trust instrument expressly indicates that are exercisable in a non-fiduciary capacity, and that they have to be exercised in that capacity to accomplish some federal tax objective of the settlor. One example would be in terms of structuring intentionally defective grantor trusts. A lot of people recognize that when we're setting up these trusts, we give the settlor a power to reacquire assets by substituting assets of equivalent value. Under the statute, that power has to be exercisable in a non-fiduciary capacity. So that would just be one example of a power that would fit within this exception.
I think this all makes sense to carve out because it doesn't make sense to then have an IGIT or a revocable trust then be in this scheme of a directed trust part of the statute. So I agree. So then what happens next? We have this trust director who has this power of direction. They direct the directed trustee to do something. How does that sort of work mechanically? What happens next?
This is, I think, the most important part of the statute. And even though this is a fairly comprehensive statute that deals with a lot of the details about how a directed trust will work, this is really where the rubber hits the road. Section 166.14a of the probate code says that the directed trustee has to take reasonable action to comply with the trust director's exercise or non-exercise of a power of direction. So they have to take reasonable action to follow the direction. And if they do so, the trustee is not liable for the action that they've been directed to do. This really, again, I can't underscore enough how important this is, because when the trustee is being told to do something, they may not agree that that's the right thing to do in that situation, but they still need to take reasonable action. Unless, and this is a big unless, to the extent that they follow that direction, they'd be engaging in willful misconduct.
So I think a common misconception is that the trust director is the one to actually act. They're the one signing the paperwork and things like that. But it doesn't work that way, right, Michael? It's really the trust director directing the directed trustee to act. So they would just give them a letter of direction. You sign the paperwork to actually execute whatever it is, the act that they need to do. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So let's just take a simple example of a trust where we've got a trust director who has the power to direct distributions. And they make their own determination in their fiduciary capacity that the trust should distribute $100 to one of the beneficiaries. They direct the trustee to make the distribution, and the trustee doesn't have to sit there and wring its own hands about whether or not this is the best idea, or should it be $100, or should it be $82, or should they inquire more with what the beneficiary needs. The trustee has to take reasonable action to comply with the direction to make the distribution.
And in that case, it's the directed trustee who's actually writing the check to the beneficiary and not the trust director who's writing the check to the beneficiary, right? I think that's what I see a lot, at least from our Delaware business, when we clean up directed trust, where it's the trust director who signed a bunch of paperwork that they weren't really supposed to sign because it was the directed trustee who has the power to execute, right? So I just wanted to make that point.
That's exactly right. Because even in a directed trust, the trustee's name is on title.
Correct.
The bank account is going to say, trustee, as trustee of the such and such trust. They're not going to list on the account who the investment director is or who all the other people are on the title to the house that the trust owns, anything else. It is still the trustee on title. And to the outside world, it is still the trustee who has the authority to deal with this asset. So the trustee needs to take whatever actions are necessary, whether it's writing a check or selling property or otherwise dealing with someone outside of the trust structure directly. And the trust director is the one who is really pulling the strings of whatever decision is made.
Unless there may be willful misconduct. So let's jump into that. So willful misconduct is the standard in the California statute. What does that mean?
So unfortunately, the statute doesn't define what willful misconduct is. So from the trust context, we actually don't know what exactly it means and how it's going to be applied. All we can really do is look at the helpful hints where willful misconduct is defined in the tort case law and workers' compensation cases. So while we can't really look at the facts of these cases and analogize them to trust and estates cases, they do provide some good sound bites that essentially put us within the parameters of what willful misconduct means. And so the cases ultimately conclude that it is unlike negligence or gross negligence, where it's a certain level of carelessness that gets you in trouble, but rather willful misconduct involves a more positive intent actually to harm another or to do an act with a positive, active, and absolute disregard of its consequences. So what we're talking about here is pretty egregious conduct that just doesn't sound right.
But again, because this is a new statute, like you pointed out, we don't have any direct case law on this issue. Like maybe other states who've had their directed trust statutes may have those case laws. Is that right?
That's right. So we haven't had it tested yet. And then the statute doesn't define it, whereas other states do have more guidance in this area.
So practically speaking, let's say that I am the directed trustee. And I don't know whether or not I should take action because of this willful misconduct standard. Like you said, maybe it just doesn't sound right. I don't know, maybe, right? So what do I need to do then?
First, even though we don't have a definition of willful misconduct, we have an idea of where it is on the scale of bad things you can do as a fiduciary, right? It's worse than negligence. And it's worse than gross negligence. So if you're a trustee and you're being directed to do something and you know it's at least negligent and you know it's at least grossly negligent, but you're not quite sure, does this go all the way to willful misconduct, which to me is sort of layman's definition would say it's wrong and you know it's wrong, but you do have the option to petition the court and to ask the court, I've been asked to do this thing. I need to follow my duty to reasonably comply with this direction I've been given, but I don't want to engage in willful misconduct. And it's not for me really to make this decision. Court, can you tell me? Because this is a real borderline case. But I'm hopeful that we're not going to have so many incidents where people are being asked to do things that are really bad, but you're just not sure if they're so bad it's willful misconduct, or if it's just kind of bad enough that it's gross negligence or recklessness.
Sure. And going back with the willful misconduct standard, and this is where I think is the biggest hangup of the California statute. Now, do other states have that same standard?
Some states do. The most well-known state is Delaware, which also has a willful misconduct statute. And because California's act is really an importation of the Uniform Directed Trust Act. Any other states that have adopted the Uniform Directed Trust Act will likely also have the willful misconduct standard. However, there are other standards. For example, New Hampshire doesn't have any standard. The directed trustee just needs to follow the directions and doesn't need to worry about the result.
So that's really interesting that some states do, some states do not have the willful misconduct standard. But now let's transition to talking about the trust director's duties and liabilities. Because again, remember, the willful misconduct standard applies to the directed trustee's duties and liabilities, right? So let's now talk about the trust director.
So as we discussed, the trustee is for the most part off the hook in taking direction. So then that leaves open the question, well, who's responsible? And so in the statute, section 16.6.12a kicks in and pretty much says that all of the duties and liabilities that apply to a trustee in a traditional trust similarly apply to the trust directors. So just as an example, we know that the trustee has a duty to treat beneficiaries impartially. And so when you have a distribution director who's responsible for making distribution directions, they have that same responsibility. So they have the duty to treat the beneficiaries impartially. Similarly, where the trustees have certain investment standards that they have to meet under the California Probate Code, those standards similarly apply to an investment director who's given those powers.
So does that mean because they have those duties that they can be liable, right? So maybe if a beneficiary has an issue with a trust director's direction for something, then they would go after the trust director?
That's absolutely right. And so within the California Probate Code, before the enactment of the Directed Trust Act, there were certain limits that the trust instrument can exculpate the trustee. And so any provision that seeks to exculpate a trustee for acts of gross negligence or worse is invalid under the code. And so similar limitations apply here. So really, you can't exculpate the acts of the directors for any conduct that's worse than negligence. So they're really on the hook.
Yeah. Okay. That's really good to know. And then also, you know, during this process, we have the directed trustee and the trust director. They're obviously talking to each other and sharing information in order to execute whatever decision was made. So what do we need to know about that piece of it?
So as you expect, the trust director and directed trustee have a duty under the statute to share information with each other to the extent that that information is reasonably related to the powers and duties of either of them. And each of the trust director and the directed trustee, if they rely on information shared with them by the other, they're not liable for a breach of trust to the extent that that breach resulted from relying on the information the other one shares. Unless, of course, by that action, they've engaged in willful misconduct.
Anything else that we need to talk about or share about the California statute?
One thing I'll just point out that goes hand in hand with that duty to share information, that doesn't go so far as to say that the directed trustee and the trust director need to monitor each other. They can share all the information, but they don't need to keep an eye on the other and make sure that the other is doing a good job. And they also don't need to tell the beneficiaries if they think that they'd do a better job. So for example, if a trust director tells the directed trustee to take an action like make a distribution or make an investment, the trustee doesn't have to tell the beneficiary, you know, I'm going to do this because the trust director told me to do it, but I think it's a pretty bad idea. And if I was in charge, I'd do something else.
That's good to know. Anything else we want to talk about with this particular statute?
I would just add that there's one more helpful feature in the statute that provides, in the same way that you could bifurcate the duties and liabilities of the trustee between a trustee and a trust director, you could similarly bifurcate the roles of two co-trustees. And so you can have two sets of co-trustees, and each of them are given certain responsibilities and are relieved of the obligation to monitor one another. And so one point about that is that labels don't really matter. As long as you provide in the trust instrument that these individuals or these roles are bifurcated and not responsible for the others, they continue to apply. And then this is an update from prior California law where co-trustees generally have some level of responsibility to monitor or seek to redress a breach of trust committed by the other co-trustee. This statute now provides that you can essentially allow each trustee to just stay in their lane and not have to look at the other co-trustee's work.
Since you've mentioned co-trustee, I'm trying to think of situations where sometimes delegation, like one co-trustee can delegate to another co-trustee, or maybe delegate different ministerial acts to other people. what is really the difference between delegation versus directed trust?
This is a really common question, and it's a great one because the concepts are similar, although there's a marked difference between them. So we've had a delegation power for a long time in California law, and that's featured in section 16052 of the probate code. And what that says is that a trustee can delegate investment and management functions as prudent under the circumstances. However, when the trustee makes a decision to delegate investment and management, say to a financial advisor, the trustee still has three very important duties. First, they have to exercise prudence when selecting an agent. Then they need to establish the scope and terms of the delegation that's consistent with the purposes of the trust. And third, they need to periodically review the agent's overall performance and compliance with the terms of the delegation. So this means that the trustee can delegate over these duties that are fiduciary duties that the trustee has. The trustee can delegate it to someone else, but they need to do a good job selecting that person. They need to give good instructions and have the scope of what the delegation of the power is. And finally, they need to keep an eye on that person. So they still retain fiduciary duties with regard to that function that they're delegating.
And with the directed trustee, all those requirements go out the door.
I wouldn't say all go out the door completely, but it's a different situation like the one we've been talking about. In a directed trust, the trustee is not making the decision ad hoc to delegate the authority. The trustee has to follow the rules in the trust instrument, which ostensibly the settlor has set forth. And if in those rules it says that the trustee does not have the power to make decisions about something, say investments in this case, but instead needs to follow directions from the trust director, then all the trustee needs to worry about is complying with those directions and doing their best not to engage in willful misconduct. So it's a much better situation for the trustee to be in terms of liability, because they don't need to worry about monitoring the trust director or setting up an investment plan or even selecting who the investment director is. They just need to make sure they follow the instructions and don't engage in willful misconduct.
I think that's a good distinction to make, delegation versus this directed trust situation. So one last question. So let's say that I do have a current trust, maybe an irrevocable trust, and the directed trust structure is something that seems very interesting to me. Obviously, I have this irrevocable trust. What can I do to turn my non-directed trust to a directed trust?
So there's a few things you can do. And because you specified irrevocable trust, I also want to take a second after I answer your question just to talk about revocable trusts as well. But for an irrevocable trust, if you have a trust that just has the trustee with all powers and duties, and you want to be able to split those duties and have it be a directed trust, you could decant the trust. California has previously adopted the Uniform Decanting Act. That can sometimes be a little bit of a hassle because under the act, you would need to appoint a guardian ad litem to the extent there are any minor or unborn beneficiaries in the structure. You could also modify the trust under California's modification sections. And I'm thinking of 15403, where all beneficiaries can request modification of a trust with a petition to the court, or 15404, where all beneficiaries in the settlor can modify a trust without a court petition. But be careful, in 15404, because it states that all beneficiaries are necessary to modify the trust, you again come into the issue of if there are minor or unborn beneficiaries, will you need to get a guardian ad litem to represent their interests? Another option is that you could move the trust out of California by appointing a trustee in another state. Many other states have non-judicial settlements or easier to use decanting statutes. That's another option. I want to get back to just what I mentioned at the start of answering this question is I think something that may get overlooked is that this directed trust statute is also a good option for people who are setting up revocable trusts and thinking about how will this trust be administered after my death and it becomes irrevocable. I think this is one real opportunity for California trust planning that may not be utilized so far as much in states like Delaware and Nevada and Wyoming and other states that have had directed trust statutes. Most California residents have California revocable trusts, and this is an opportunity to set up a directed trust after the settlor has passed away, which until now, there hasn't really been that opportunity without going through some of the hassle to set up a revocable trust under the laws of another state.
I think that's a really, really good point. Well, thank you both so much, Michael and David, for joining us. And that's all the time that we have for today. Michael and David have given us their contact information. Please see the show notes for that information. Thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next time on Trust Me.
Trust Me is a production of the Trusts and Estates section of the California Lawyers Association and produced by Foley Mara Studios. For further information, please go to calawyers.org, click on Sections, Trusts and Estates, and look for the Education tab to learn about upcoming live programs, online CLE and webcasts, as well as a broad range of low-cost self-study programs. Many of our guests are contributors to the Trusts and Estates Quarterly, the official publication of the section. Benefits of membership include the quarterly, along with email case alerts and other opportunities to stay current in the trusts and estates field. Please consider subscribing to this podcast so that you don't miss our next episode. And thanks for listening to Trust Me.